Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A fascinating subject for intelligence scrutiny and a lot of political high drama, I think it's fair to say, involves the disappearance and presumed liquidation of a man by the name of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, evidently, to talk about what was the role that this chap Khashoggi was playing as a legal permanent resident in the United States, how he got that status, among other things, and what he was doing vis-a-vis the government of Saudi Arabia is a friend of this program, a man I enjoy visiting with from time to time very much. His name is Matthew Brodsky. He is one of our country's most thoughtful analysts of what's going on in the Middle East, and what's happening in connection with this story is no exception. Matt Brodsky, it's good to have you back. I saw your piece in the Spectator US the other day about why the media is ignoring a whole series of glaring questions about Jamal Khashoggi. Maybe you could use that as sort of the prism to explain who he really was and what he was up to that might have got him killed.
Right. I think the American media has done a really good job of repeatedly shooting itself in the foot when it comes to its credibility. And of course, the Khashoggi affair essentially shines another light on that, in which it focused on reporting that he was essentially some reform-minded Democrat who was just concerned about bringing democracy to the world. And he was just a journalist. I mean, in reality, we know that he is an avid supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood when that part. And of course, they said that in a Washington Post article he wrote in August in the headline.
Hard to mistake it.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, but still, even with that evidence, it's you still have most mainstream reporters trying to cover it as though he were simply a Democrat and a journalist. We know from Patrick Poole, another national security correspondent for PJ Media, he discovered that in 1998, there were two articles that he wrote for the Arab News while embedded in Afghanistan with bin Laden. These two articles from May 1998 happened just after Abdullah Azzam ended up writing his article, which formed the basis for what Al-Qaeda would become. And it was a few months before, because it was August 1988, as I recall, that Al-Qaeda came into existence. So we have, and he was placed there, incidentally, it's reasonable to assume, through his contact, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, in the royal family, who is, of course, on the opposite side of the succession Game of Thrones version, shall we say, that's happening.
Specifically, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. And Turki Al-Faisal was, of course, head of Saudi intelligence for a time. And I've been told by David Goldman, one of my trusted sources on a lot of things, that indeed this fellow was actually an intelligence operative for Turki Al-Faisal, working undercover as a journalistic sort, but nonetheless sort of involved in media manipulation. And it seems as though post-mortem, if indeed he's dead, that manipulation continues, doesn't it? So talk quickly, Matt, we're going to run out of time here before we run out of things to talk with you about, but bring in the interest that you mentioned, the Muslim Brotherhood, that would be for one, but Turkey, Qatar, two countries that are now very deeply involved in helping the Brotherhood, and not least Iran, all have in fomenting a real crisis in U.S.-Saudi relations over this horrific, evidently, hit by somebody working for the government of Saudi Arabia, we're told.
Right. I think you can see this play out in media, specifically in the region, according to who they support. We know that there are certain networks that will remain nameless. If you watch them right now or actually go on their show, as I've done, you will see the focus on all of these small details. Now, Turkey is leaking out information slowly, and for once, Erdogan is quiet. Erdogan, of course, the guy who calls everyone a Nazi, he's got a long list, just look that up. But now he's been quiet, allowing drip, drip, drip through the media, all through unverified state sources. That is not literally this is not the same thing as reporters doing investigative journalism. We know Turkey and Qatar do not like the Saudi Arabia. They're Muslim Brotherhood supporters. And of course, they're considered a terrorist organization inside of Saudi Arabia. So there's no friendship here. And everyone has an axe to grind.
Right. Well, more than axe to grind, I think they've got axes they would like to plant in the heads of Saudi Arabia and perhaps the United States as well. So, Matt, this raises the question of what President Trump should do in response to this attack on an American legal resident, albeit of Saudi extraction. I myself believe that there's an opportunity for a twofer here, but let me get your thoughts quickly.
Well, certainly there's a wide array of possibilities and suggestions people are giving to President Trump. The ones that seem more down the middle is, first of all, you definitely want to send a signal that this is absolutely unacceptable. The U.S. does not stand by this. So there should be some form of sanctions. Perhaps the Magnitsky Act could be used to target, for humanitarian reasons, part of the royal family, as it may turn out, whoever it is that did this or has decided that did this. The U.S. used that, of course, with Turkey against the Interior and Justice Ministers when it came to the detention of Pastor Brunson. So that's one thing that would keep the focus on humanitarian issues while still allowing our alliance to proceed, which we need them in our coalition against Iran, understanding fully in support of a coalition to push back on Iran and to reform its kingdom. There are other options, of course. Some would like to see the Muslim Brotherhood declared as a terrorist organization. That's another thing to be explored. The most important aspect, though, is that we do not trash our bilateral relationship, which is something that, of course, those from the previous administration are avidly advocating and writing about and being interviewed about, because they'd like us to see us back in the nuclear deal with Iran and to turn our back.
They were on the other side for sure. Matt, I'm among those who believe that we should make sure that the bad guys in this deal, and I think that would be Turkey, Qatar, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Iran, don't prosper from whatever sanctions are imposed on the Saudis. And I think designating the Muslim Brotherhood be one way to do that. There's another option. I hope all of these will be before President Trump. And Matt Brodsky, I appreciate you giving your insights to us and hopefully to an awful lot of other people about what this really means and what we should do about it, the Khashoggi affair. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Uzay Bulut will talk with us next. We'll drill down more on what's going on in Turkey right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
It is a great pleasure to say not only welcome back to you, but to our next guest. Her name is Uzay Bulut. She is one of the most courageous journalists I know and one who has been doing exceptionally important work in reporting on her native Turkey and what it is up to, not only in its own region, but here in America as well. I am thrilled to say she is a fellow with the Gatestone Institute, where she is now publishing quite frequently and quite important pieces, and we're going to talk with her today about several of them. But first, let me say, Uzay, thank you so much for coming back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was speaking in the previous segment with Matt Brodsky about the Jamal Khashoggi affair. And of course, that went down, as you know, in Turkey, in the Saudi consulate there, we believe. The Turks have been very much involved in, I think, promoting the worst possible portrayal of what's gone on. And it sounds as though there's a lot of awful things associated with it. But I just wonder if you might comment on Turkey's interest here in helping to, well, intensify, shall we say, a rift between the United States and Saudi Arabia. You've contributed to a book we've written recently called Turkey Ally No More, and this would seem to be kind of a piece with that. But walk us through it as you see it.
Well, Turkey Turkey is trying to damage or harm the relations between Saudi Arabia and the United States, particularly because there is now a reformist administration or prince in Saudi Arabia trying to show the murder of the journalist in a horrifying light. But and whatever Turkey's agenda in that is, I think the United States government should not take it very seriously, because when we look at how Turkey, the Turkish government itself, is mistreating and abusing and arresting its own journalists, I think the Turkish government is one of the least, I mean, Turkish government authorities are one of the least authorities or persons on earth to criticize the treatment of journalists by other governments, by other countries.
Yeah, very good point. This calls to mind kind of what they've been doing more generally to lots of people that they don't care for, notably the Gulenists in Turkey. That would be the faction that Recep Tayyip Erdogan blames for having tried to mount a coup against his government some time ago. Uzey Bulut, do you see in this campaign against the Gulenists and journalists and, you know, opposition politicians and business leaders and the like, anything really more than just an old-fashioned sort of totalitarian effort to concentrate and wield power by Erdogan?
Well, Erdogan is trying to exterminate all dissident voices and minorities in Turkey, and he has been doing it very effectively, because when we look at the political climate in the country right now, it's really getting more and more difficult to figure out and find sources to understand, to learn what's going on inside the country, because he has, you know, closed down hundreds of media outlets. It is a typical totalitarian way of cracking down and silencing all dissident voices, but also he is trying to transform the country completely, culturally and politically, and he's been very successful at that.
Yeah. I also wanted to talk with you about something that you've been writing on, I think very importantly, Uzey Bulut, notably at the Gatestone Institute, namely the effort that Erdogan is making to export the kind of, well, I think of it as Sharia supremacism, that, as you say, he is trying to transform the country he rules or misrules into a kind of prime exponent of. Would you talk a little bit about specifically what you've covered in terms of the influence operations and espionage, the spying that Erdogan is doing through vehicles like the Diyanet and its institutions, notably a very, very large mosque in our own country?
Yes, that's much more, to the United States government, obviously, that's much more important than what Turkey is doing internally. And when we were talking about the political climate in Turkey, I think Diyanet, which is the acronym of Turkey's Directorate of Religious Affairs, is the institution that all U.S. citizens should be familiar with. It's one of the most measured state institutions right now, and it is set to receive about more than 10 million Turkish liras for next year. And its activities include building mosques all across the world, actually. I mean, across four continents, including the United States. And these mosques, as the head of the Diyanet also made it clear that they are not just places of worship. They are also schools, and apparently, when we look at the Turkish reports and also other reports on international media outlets, they are also used as spy centers where imams and other employees gather intelligence information about Turkish citizens in those countries, and they report this information to the authorities in Ankara. So some very reliable reports have been published in European outlets, and even the European Parliament members have pointed out that the activities of Diyanet affiliated mosques should be investigated more clearly because of the spying activities they've been engaging in. So I wrote this article and asked the question whether the Diyanet affiliated mosques in the United States are also gathering intelligence information and doing spying activities on behalf of the Turkish government, which is very, very possible, because if they are doing it all across the world in all other countries, so why shouldn't they be doing it in the United States?
Yeah, and they're doing it, let's be clear, under the cover of religious activity.
Yes, they are doing it under the cover of religious freedom, and they know that the United States is very sensitive and protective of this right. So, and also Europe. So they are abusing and exploiting these freedoms, and then doing spying activities in places which are supposed to be places of worship.
Yeah, there's so much to talk with you about, Uzay, and I just wanted to finish with one further thought. You mentioned this sort of effort to expand the reach of the Sharia supremacists in places like Europe through demographic jihad. You've also written very powerfully about what they're doing to suppress Christians and other religious minorities inside Turkey. We saw, praise be to God, the release finally of Pastor Andrew Brunson. But very quickly, if you could just tell us what's happening to Christians and other people of faith who are in the crosshairs of the Erdogan regime at the moment.
Well, first of all, there's a very tiny Christian minority in Turkey, because most have already been killed or deported or exterminated before Erdogan came to power. But there's still a minority, a Christian and Jewish minority. And of course, they are persecuted. And actually, their leaders have recently been forced by the government to sign a document which says that they are under no pressure and they live as free citizens of the country, which is ironic at worst. But what I want to actually emphasize is that while Turkey persecutes its own minorities or Christians and Jews and other, Yazidi and other religious minorities, what the Turkish government is doing, and I think which is extremely alarming, is that they are trying to promote and enable uncontrolled Muslim migration into Europe. And there are reports in the Turkish media which say that thousands of people, particularly from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other countries, arrive in Turkey every day. They first go to a city in eastern Turkey, which is determined as a transit place, and then they arrive in Istanbul, and they work as undocumented workers. But their main destination, this is a piece of information which I received from almost all major newspapers in Turkey, they all want to arrive in Germany through Greece, Serbia, and Hungary. So while Turkey persecutes Christians inside its boundaries, they are very systematically and consistently promoting this type of mass migration. And then we're to ask if this government and the believers of that religion, not only in Turkey but also in all majority Muslim countries, treat Christians like that. how will they treat the Christians in Europe when they, you know, get a certain power, or when they, you know, when they become the majority there? Because the aging of the European population is a demographic reality in Europe right now. So I think this is the number one problem, the most serious and the most urgent problem that people in Europe should be focused on right now.
We must as well. And Uze Bulut, thank you so much for the work that you do with the Gatestone Institute to help call our attention to these sorts of problems. I hope you'll come back and let us spend a longer time together really exploring them in more detail. In the meantime, I thank you for your contribution to the Center for Security Policy's monograph, Turkey, Ally No More. Uze, we'll be talking. Thank you so much. Next up, we will be speaking with Dr. Mark Schneider about the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and why President Trump is right to want to get out of it, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Mark Schneider. Dr. Schneider is one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving nuclear forces and various arms control treaties and compliance therewith. He is a man who served in senior positions in the United States Defense Department. He also was on the policy planning staff at the State Department. These days, he is a senior fellow with an extraordinarily important organization, the National Institute for Public Policy. Dr. Schneider is, I believe, the man who first publicly discussed and broke the story, really, on the Russians' violations of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF Treaty, it's popularly known as. And we are speaking to him, I'm very pleased to say, in the aftermath of an announcement by President Trump that on the basis of such misconduct by the Russians, we are getting out of that treaty. Dr. Schneider, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us, and thank you for your leadership on this important topic for so many, many years. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Mark, you and I go back quite a ways. I remember when I was a young pup working in the Defense Department, you mentored me on the systemic problem of the Kremlin's non-compliance with arms control treaties. What they've done with respect to the INF treaty is the norm, not an anomaly. Talk a little bit about what we know of the nature of and the strategic implications associated with the Russians' violation of the INF treaty.
Well, the Obama administration in 2014 determined that there was a very serious, and this is their language, not mine, very serious violation of the INF treaty involving a ground-launched cruise missile of prohibited range. There's, I think, no question that that's the case. Recently, the Trump administration has revealed that this is no theoretical capability, that we've actually seen them fly this missile well into the INF treaty prohibited zone, which is 500 kilometers to 5,500 kilometers. In addition to this, there are several other missiles that if these press reports are true, and I'm talking about Russian press reports, including state-run media, that would also violate the INF treaty. In November 2017, General of the Army Valery Gerasimov, chief of the Russian General Staff, stated that Russia had, and I quote, set up full-scale units of vehicles capable of delivering precision-guided missiles to targets located 4,000 kilometers away. If that's not an admission of violating the INF treaty, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, in the intelligence business, Mark, we call that a clue. we've got the general running the military saying they've effectively violated this treaty. So, Mark, again, we worked together back when the treaty was being negotiated. You were responsible at the time for strategic forces, but I know you kept your eye on what was going on here. As I recall, during my time helping President Reagan and Cap Weinberger and Richard Perl try to operationalize the idea of a zero option, as it was called, eliminating an entire class of these missiles, ground-launched cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. On our side, the Pershing II and the so-called GLICKM. On the Russian, or at the time Soviet side, it was, of course, going to be the SS-20s in particular. The reason that that was so considered to be so important and a conceptual breakthrough when the Soviets at least nominally agreed to it was, if you saw any evidence of a missile in that range, it would be a clear-cut violation. This, therefore, presumably, is such a clear-cut violation. Tell us why it's strategically, or in the theater sense at least, so of such importance to our friends and allies as well as our own forces that are now within range of these missiles.
Well, the Russians are threatening NATO and even neutrals like Finland and Sweden almost on a daily basis. They're trying to intimidate them into accepting Russian imperial domination. Now, the violations or violations, as I believe is the case of the INF Treaty, plays very much into this strategy because it gives them the ability to target essentially all of Europe with both nuclear and conventional precision weapons. And nothing like that exists in NATO because of the INF Treaty.
Yeah, and this is really the crux of the matter. As I recall very vividly, and I'm sure you do, Mark, President Reagan was insistent on NATO deploying Pershing II and GLICKM missiles precisely because he wanted to get rid of the SS-20s and knew that there was no way of doing that without having effective deployed counterparts to them. And so we went through this very challenging deployment in five different basing countries, as they were called in NATO. As you say, none of that is in place any longer, correct?
Yes. And not only that, the battlefield nuclear weapons were withdrawn and on our side anyway, and eliminated under the so-called presidential nuclear initiatives of 1991-1992.
Those were George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yes. The Russians signed up to that and then wholesale violated it. And that's in the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review report. This is not me saying this. There's no question that the Russians are in large-scale violation of that as well. And you put the two together, they have capabilities that are existential threats to NATO, and we have no deterrent capability. Now, we've begun a long process of rebuilding that deterrent as a result of Trump administration decisions.
But when you say that deterrent, if I'm not mistaken, Mark, you would be talking about strategic nuclear forces, not tactical nuclear forces, not in-kind deterrence, in other words, right, unless they take some other step to build one and deploy it, right?
Well, yeah, the nuclear SLICM is part of the 2018 NPR, and that's a non-strategic. Also, the systems they're talking about now as a response to the INF Treaty would be non-strategic. A version of the ATACM with a range of probably just over 500 kilometers, possibly a ground-launched cruise missile that would respond to the Russian violations of the INF Treaty.
These are new systems, or systems that would have to be significantly modified, including, I would guess, in connection with the the Army Tactical Missile System, ATACMs?
HIMARS or ATACM.
this would require a new warhead, right?
Thus far, it's been conventional only in anything I've read about it. Certainly, you could put a nuclear warhead on it, but I don't see any, I haven't heard of any plans to do so, and I doubt that that's being considered.
But if it were a conventional weapon, arguably, I mean, you're the specialist here, Mark Schneider. If it's a conventional warhead, it's not exactly a deterrent in kind to what the Russians are deploying.
It's a deterrent to violating the treaties. It's not a deterrent to the nuclear aspect of this, but it's better than nothing. No question about that. Right now, we got nothing. I mean, literally.
So, Mark Schneider, you, in the course of a very distinguished career, decades-long career in the U.S. government, I think became the keeper of the flame with respect to the history of first Soviet and then Russian non-compliance, basically with all of their treaty commitments, arms control treaty commitments especially. This fits a pattern, therefore. And is there any reason to believe, in your professional judgment, that unless and until the United States, and in this case its allies, probably both in Europe and in Asia, do put into place a deterrent in kind, that we will see more of this kind of behavior? And we haven't even talked about what the Chinese are up to, who are completely unconstrained by this treaty. They're not even violating it. They're not party to it. And talk about the sort of, again, the strategic environment that is created in the absence of this kind of deterrent in kind.
Well, it's very dangerous. We're giving the two most aggressive expansionist powerful nations in the world monopolies on very important capabilities until this decision. And this decision, it will take a while to for them to think about this and right now they're in attack mode. They're attacking us in every conceivable way. They're threatening standard types of Russian nuclear threats. But at some point, this is going to sink in, and it could have some very, very desirable effects on their behavior. I mean, I think there's little doubt that Reagan's pullout of the SALT I and SALT II treaties in 1986 because of multiple Russian violations was a main reason, one of the main reasons we got the INF treaty, the zero option, and the Star Treaty a few years later. It really shook them off. They had been used to violating treaties with impunity, and Putin is certainly used to it. He's been violating treaties since the day he got in office, and the pattern's increasing.
Well, I hope and believe that this is a product in part of not only President Trump's common sense and stalwart America First leadership, but also the strong support that he's getting from Ambassador John Bolton. Mark Schneider, thank you for the terrific contribution you've made to our national security over a very long period of time. And come back to us with updates. Next up, we will be speaking with Robert Charles right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, I'm very pleased to say, by former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles. You see him frequently at Fox News these days and doubtless read his commentaries there and elsewhere. He is one of our go-to guys because one of the things that he was responsible for in that job at the State Department was the immigration issue, the security of our border, the threat posed to us by narco traffickers on one side, now increasingly on both sides of the border, and what that's doing to our people. He is, among other things, a man who has served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He has taught law at Harvard Law. He is an attorney by training, and he is also the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens. Robert Charles, so good to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank, very much.
So I wanted to pick your brains urgently, Robert, about this, well, crisis, I guess we're being told, humanitarian crisis that is now upon us because some five or four or some number of thousands of people have decided to pick up and come from Central America through Mexico to break into the United States. The president has really thrown down the gauntlet on this, warning that they're very bad people. I'd like your thoughts about who they are and what the implications would be if we were to do something other than prevent their entry into this country.
Yeah, Frank, I can't tell you how offensive the idea is that people would organize to violate the law and that we would somehow permit that to happen. I think the president is exactly right to have drawn a line. The line happens to be our border, and said there is a legal process for getting to the United States. If you have a bona fides right as an asylee to claim asylum, we will review that right. That is a one-by-one process. That isn't 5,000 people crossing the border en masse and trying to open the gates like at some sort of rock concert. This is about methodically following the law. Or you can be a refugee, and that has other standards associated with it that you acquire, incidentally, at your embassy. So there's no question. Guatemala is a troubled place. But the notion that you should allow this sort of political caravan to somehow break down the border of the United States and come in, the president is more than right. He's right 100 times over. You need to, first of all, use all legal assets with CBP and DHS. You need to encourage the Mexican government to stand up and do what's right, which is not to permit this to happen, and to turn them back at their own border, which they don't appear to be doing. And finally, you need to be prepared with our own military to properly protect the United States border. Borders are protected by militaries.
And the question that occurs in response to some of the president's rhetoric about who's coming in this caravan, Judge Jeanine Pirot, our friend at Fox News, I think dealt with this very ably in her monologue this weekend. She talked about the imperative of vetting these people, knowing, as you do, Robert Charles, who are some of the people who wish to get into our country? And it's not to say there aren't people who have legitimate humanitarian problems or challenges, but is it, in your professional judgment, likely that among the people coming in this caravan are certainly, well, drug traffickers or other criminal elements, and quite possibly ISIS or other jihadist terrorists?
Yeah, it's not even a matter of likely, Frank. There are hardened criminals both behind and a part of this organization, as there historically have always been. Border traffickers are willing to violate, the sovereignty of the United States, chiefly for reasons that serve them. And many of those are criminal reasons. I will tell you that I have absolutely no doubt in this group of 5,000 that are headed this way. You have people. I'm going to draw an analogy to the idea that in really nefarious environments where morality has gone, has completely vanished, you end up with human shields being used, innocents, to promote the advance of like ISIS did in the Middle East, to promote the advance of some sort of force. And in a way, these are human shields. There are absolutely, undoubtedly, children and innocents in this group. But drug traffickers, as well as human traffickers, as well as potential traffickers of material and terrorist activities, are always seeking to sort of magnetically attach themselves to this kind of a group, and push forward.
Now, the idea of human shields is really important. Robert Charles, I appreciate you bringing that forward. Among the other things, of course, in your eminent career, you focused on was the kinds of drugs that are being brought in by organized elements south of our border. Particularly insidious category is something called fentanyl that the Chinese are apparently manufacturing in what can only be seen, I think, as an attack on the people of the United States with mortal effects. Talk about what's going on there and the likelihood that this problem is going to get worse if we don't actually have a wall to restrict such trafficking.
So, Frank, I appreciate this question because, as you probably know, I've spent a lot of time in international counter-narcotics, and it is truly an unprecedented set of events we're witnessing for two reasons. One, fentanyl is probably the most deadly, it's not the most deadly, but virtually the most deadly commonly found synthetic opioid in the United States. It's 50 times more potent than heroin, and it essentially amounts to a weapon of sorts in its own way, because if someone, even a law enforcement officer, gets too close with fentanyl, or even worse, carfentanyl, you end up with physical effects that are detrimental. 14% of the 3,000 cases of overdose from fentanyl in 2010, 3,000 cases of overdose occurred in 2010. And of that 3,000 from either opioids or synthetic opioids, 14% were fentanyl. Jump now to 2016, where 50% of 19,000 plus are directly tied to fentanyl. And where does fentanyl come from? It comes from 600 producers in China. And could China turn that off? You bet. They could turn it off in a minute. And so what we need to do, DEA, frankly, our State Department and the White House, and the president did speak on this in August, we need to go after China, elevate this. This should be, fentanyl should be known to every single American as a sort of a tip of the spear in the form of Chinese state support for something that will help to debilitate the United States. And if you think they're using information technology and hacking against us, just pause for a moment and look at the parallel effects that you get from destroying a society by elevating drug addiction, and in particular killing people through fentanyl. Yeah, China is responsible. Pat Toomey, Senator Toomey, has a bill up right now to try to implement a little more sanction-oriented activity against China, but I think it has to go beyond that. I think you have to be very aggressive and say, look, there is no room for a country to transship intentionally or not to block, as a totalitarian society, the production and transshipment of a drug that is clearly destroying the youth of the United States. It is a very dangerous drug. Not the only drug. Cocaine is dangerous. Heroin is dangerous. Marijuana encourages, addiction. But this is a big, big issue.
But you said something that I hadn't heard before. It stands to reason, but it's a further very troubling feature of this drug, fentanyl, is that simply handling it by law enforcement could put them in some risk as well. Did I understand you correctly?
Yeah, let me be clear about that. There are levels of purity associated with synthetic opioids, and to be more general about it, the more pure an opioid, a synthetic opioid, is, up to the point where there are drugs that are coming into this country that are synthetic opioids that if someone handles them, or if you even had, literally the powder you don't need very much of it in order for it to adversely affect, let's say, a drug sniffing dog, in order to affect a law enforcement officer. So public health and safety are number one concerns for every American and every civil leader in the United States. And I would say that focusing harder on addictive drugs, and in particular where they come from, and that really means in this case with fentanyl, China, is a number one priority.
Listen, Robert, before we run out of time, I did want to just touch base with you on one other thing. You served in the senior ranks of the State Department, and I imagine you've got some sense, even if it's not been your direct focus for most of your career, of how the bureaucracy in the State Department has basically been enabling first Soviet and then Russian non-compliance with treaties, mostly by insisting that we not find them in violation of them or hold them accountable if we might. We just had an excellent conversation with Dr. Mark Schneider about the fact that even the Obama administration recognized the Russians were in violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Any thoughts on the importance of what President Trump is doing to try to hold these guys, as I say, accountable?
Yes, Frank, I think that what he's doing is the right choice. I think the reasoning behind it is that you must hold Russia accountable.
We have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm afraid, Robert Charles, so much more to talk with you about. We look forward to doing so with you in the near future. And come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.